Good afternoon. So today we'll finish up talking about performance and move on to our next topic, which is exceptions. So last time we talked about two ways of getting more parallelism out of our processors. So one of them was this idea of multiple accumulators, that modern processors run multiple instructions at the same time through pipelining and through just having multiple copies of the things that execute instructions. And you want to write your code in ways which exposes more options. And we looked at the critical path, sort of that data flow and graph picture of what computation was happening as a way of figuring out when you had more options for the processor to do things in parallel and when things would be bottlenecked by some sequence of operations which need to happen one, then the other, then the other, then the other, no matter how clever the processor was about actually writing the instructions. We also talked about vector instructions, which are a way of explicitly telling the processor, hey, I have four things I'd like you to do at the same time. And we looked at Intel's mechanism for exposing that to C on the assumption that often the compiler won't figure out exactly what to do right, so you can tell it explicitly, but still have the compiler worry about like writing the code that deals with your loop indexes and accessing your arrays and things like that. So that is not the only interface that's out there for vector instructions besides assembly. So GCC has some extensions which are mentioned briefly in our textbook but aren't actually used very often as far as I know, which look more like normal C code. They have the major advantage of working on more than x86, so like if you want to write vector code that also might be fast on ARM maybe, that would be an option because the intrinsic functions we showed you correlate to specific instructions which won't exist on, say, ARM. And it has the disadvantage of it being less clear when your plus operation actually turns into one instruction or if the compiler is going to have to turn it into four separate instructions to make it work. Also, GPUs, the way GPUs essentially work is that they have all vector instructions. And CUDA is the most common way people use to program GPUs and things like it, and that's based on a very different way of programming this, and that's where you write the operations for each vector lane like you're writing a multi-threaded program, like you're writing multiple, if you don't know what threads are, like multiple programs will run at the same time on different data. That's the programming model. There's extra hardware support to make it so you can actually like write useful programs that way and still have it use vector instructions. That's a very different programming model, but the things you need to think about as far as what's going to be fast are the same, because ultimately what the machine is doing is taking a bunch of values and doing the same thing with them, and you still need to organize your computation in a way which takes advantage of that to make GPUs be fast for you, even though they have this arguably friendlier programming model. So I'm going to talk about two more topics related to performance, one of which is mostly because it sometimes confuses people on the assignment, and the other of which is probably the most important thing I can say about performance. So first, the confusion on the assignment. So if you have some code like this, it has tons of multiplying times n. Right. So it looks like if you do the straightforward translation of this code, that we have two multiply instructions in that innermost loop, and multiply instructions aren't super fast. So it might be nice to not have those multiply instructions, which are just for accessing values, and we can get rid of them by doing something like this, where we have a pointer and we advance it by n each time because what we're changing to multiply by changes by 1 each time. And in fact, compilers are actually pretty good at finding this optimization. They have fancy analysis of loops to say, oh, this thing changes by one every loop iteration, this thing therefore changes by n, and they figure out how to do this transformation for you most of the time. So the reason I'm mentioning it is that, you know, sometimes they won't do it. And because like you made your loop more complicated, maybe you're doing some funny cache blocking thing that makes the compiler not be able to figure this out. That might make it not do it. And you might see the code get slower And it's not because your cache blocking doesn't work, it's because you're wasting all this time doing multiplications. Another reason is that sometimes when the compiler does it, it will create kind of inefficient code. So for example, this transformation done this way here created an extra variable. And if we had lots of things that that was done to, we might run out of registers. And hopefully the compiler is smart enough to figure out how not to do that, but maybe not. And that's a reason code can end up being slower. It could add these extra variables to avoid the multiplication and run out of registers and therefore spill to the stack. And the definitive way to tell if that's going on is to look at the assembly. I know most of you won't do that, but this is the sort of thing which can go on. And a fix you can do yourself is you can make sure that, you know, you can be explicit and see if you think this sort of thing might be going on. And you know, manipulate the pointers in an efficient way yourself, assuming the compiler won't figure out how to do it. But most of the time, you'll be okay. But I mention it because always, I think probably a few students will run across a case where they make this fancy version of like rotate or smooth, and suddenly the compiler does something really bad with it, even though it seems not too different from another version. And it seems like it's doing more optimizations. So that's the one which I said, you know, it's just because it comes up on the assignment sometimes, not for everyone, for a few people. And it's confusing. And I think worth knowing that compilers do that in general. Okay, so the other thing is about priorities and optimization. So in the lab and in our homework assignment, we have like one function and we're telling you make it as fast as possible. In the real world, you're like gonna have a program and you want to spend your time optimizing what matters. If you have a program that spends 90% of its time reading files, you should not be spending your time making the computation faster. That is a waste of your time. You want to figure out how you can make it read files faster, if you can. If you have a program which spends 90% of its time in routine A, and you're optimizing routine B, even if routine B is very important, it's not going to help you make the program faster. And to avoid making this sort of mistake, which is really common, when people want to make a program fast, they often just say, well, B is the biggest, most important thing the program does, so that's where I'm going to put my effort. Or, oh, it's so slow, I'll just speed up the computation. I know how to do that, I know about loop unrolling now. And they'll find out, oh, wait, it's just reading files all the time. So your first step should be a tool called a profiler, a tool to determine where your program spends time. So the idea is you run your program on something which is representative of what you care about. So like not some toy problem, but one which matches, you know, the problems that you want actually to be fast. And you look at where you spend time. So I will demo a profiler on my machine called Perf. And I need a program to do this on. And I'm going to use HCLRS. So HCLRS, it's like it's over 1,000 lines. So it's a real program and it's not going to be obvious how it would make it faster. And so we'll start with something which runs probably slower than it should. So I have a solution to the seek homework. And I have this, I should show you the file first, this infinite-loop.yo. And I think that I should be able to run this infinite-loop.yo for, say, a million cycles, and that should be pretty fast. But it's not. This is going to take quite a while. So I'd like to look at what can I do if I want this to be faster. And, you know, I can, you know, think about what is this doing, why is it taking so long, and I might have guesses as to what's slow. Maybe that routine which evaluate muxes is slow, or something like that. You know, because I'm going through the list, maybe I can optimize that. But really, I should run a profiler. So the profiler I'm going to use is called Perf. It has a man page. It's for Linux. You'd have a different profiler on a non-Linux system, and the other profiler is for Linux too. And what it does is I run a program in it, and every once in a while, it stops the program and looks at what's running right now. and records that. And then I can look at that later. So this is called a sampling-based profiler. So every once in a while it takes a sample of what's going on, and hopefully that all the samples overall tell you what's happened. So I can run this with the command is perf record. I'm going to save to perf.data. I'm going to pass this option, call graph equals dwarf, which is going to tell it, don't just record what's running each time you take a sample, but record what called it. So record the whole call stack. And I'm going to give the command I want to run, which is the same. That slow HTLRS command. And this will run that, but it's going to stop it every once in a while and record what's going on. And you can see that it tells me at the end it wrote about a megabyte of data, which is composed of a little over 100 samples. So it stopped the program 100 times, recorded everything that was going on, all the functions that were running, and wrote that down. And perf has a tool to look at that output file, so I can write, which is perf report. So I can use perf report on the output file. I'll use no children to start with. I'll explain what that option does later. And we get a list of where the program was stopped each time we took a sample. So this gives me a function name, locate where the binary is. And so it says, in this case, most of the time you were in the allocate function. And other times you were in the spin lock function in the kernel, whatever that is. And other times you were in this evaluate function. So knowing that, hey, most of the time you were allocating memory, that's not actually super useful because allocating memory from where? But fortunately, I recorded call stacks. So I can find out where this was called. And I say, oh, it's allocating memory in this step with trace function. That's apparently took a lot of time. I'm going to look at from now on a different output file, which I got from a longer run. So this only has 130 samples, and that's probably actually a little too small to get good data. Because like 26% is like 30 samples, I could have gotten unlucky. So I have a case where I ran this for much longer, and I have about 2,000 samples instead. But it's the same sort of output. So here I have different list of hotspots, but I have like, I'm in evaluate expression. That's where, when I ran this long program, it took a lot of time. In hash map, you want to ask the same question, where was that called? And we can break down and say, okay, most of the time you were calling that in this evaluate function. So somehow you were using a hash map and evaluate, and that was taking a lot of time. So that gives me something I can think about for optimizing. So the hash map I'm using in that evaluate function, I'm taking the name of a wire and looking up its value. So that's telling me, you know, that takes a lot of time, so you could save a bunch of time by changing that to instead look up the value by a number. Not a hash map, but like an array. And that might not be the sort of optimization I would come up with if I didn't look at a profile. I might assume, oh, my math must be slow or something like that. Okay, so this is the output which shows where the samples are, and then I can break it down. There's another way of formatting that, which is more useful, but more confusing to start out with, where we have two times. So the first column here is children. So this is the time where we stopped in that function or anything it called. So main, of course, is in most of the samples because most of the time when we took a sample, main was running. It was somewhere in the call stack. And this is usually more useful for figuring out what's going on than knowing, hey, you stopped in hash map, but not keep taking into account the various places you used a hash map. And this gives us more what we expect. So we say, okay, so we're spending 43% of our time evaluating. Only 18% of that is in our actual evaluate function, but we call things from it like that hash map lookup, and that's all those samples together are 43% of our time. And that's maybe much lower than you expected, because wouldn't we be spending most of our time evaluating wire values? So let's look at where else we're spending our time. spending a bunch of time formatting outputs. So that's weird. Why would we be spending 30% of our time formatting output? And what's happening here is that that output of between cycle X and Y, I compute that every cycle, I just don't always output it. And this is telling me, oh, if you didn't do that, you'd save about 30% of your time. And that's maybe not something I would have likely come up with if I didn't run a profiler. I might not have guessed that producing that output was taking so much of my time compared to all the actual simulation. And we can see that this is called from these various functions that are related to producing that sort of output. The dump bank function dumps a register bank contents, and so on. So this is what the sort of tool you should use when you have a real program and you want to optimize it. Yeah, we don't give you this sort of assignment because you probably would not be very happy if we said, here's a 1,000-line C program, go. But in the real world, that's the sort of scenario you're going to have. There's going to be some piece of software that has lots of pieces, and you know it's slow, but that doesn't mean you know why it's slow. Like, you probably would not have guessed why HCLRS was slow doing a long simulation. I wouldn't have, and I wrote it, so. Okay. So, so that was one profiler. So I'd note that, so that's a sampling-based profiler. You can also find profilers which is like to just count function calls or something like that. So you might find different kinds which give you different sorts of information. I prefer the sampling-based ones because they tend to give you the most accurate information. Because when you have one where you like count every function call, that means that you're taking time off of every function call rather than just periodically taking a little time away from the application, and that can distort your measurements. But the disadvantage is that to take these samples, I didn't get that many samples unless I ran for a long time. Okay. So any questions about anything related to performance before I move on to our completely other topic? So, before I forget, a logistical note. So, as I mentioned last time, the exam scores are out, and the exams are in TPEGs, and you should submit regrades. I didn't make it clear last time, there are keys on Colab in the Resources tab. So, you should be able to figure out whether, we didn't grade according to the key, which is the easiest regrade from that. And if you have questions on any of the exam questions, regardless of whether you care about having it regraded, feel free to ask. So let's start talking about exceptions with a little motivational example. So I have a piece of code here. If I run this on a lab machine, can you still use that lab machine? Who thinks yes? Yes, absolutely. Okay. So one hand, who thinks no? No, it's not going to work. How about if the lab machine has one core? I get some old processor that only has one core. Who thinks, yes, you can still use the lab machine? It will still work. Okay, most people who are volunteering opinions think so. So what's happening that makes that go on? And we can actually observe the sort of thing which is happening by changing to this ID. So here, this is not an infinite loop, but it's a long loop. And I'm just getting the time. In this case, I'm getting the time in like nanosecond precision. Then getting the time again and timing that. So that should be very, very short because there's nothing there. There's going to be a little bit of overhead to get the time. So we expected like a small constant measurement. That's sort of what we'd intuitively expect. So, and you know, there's the same instructions in between. So except for like cache misses, which should go away after the first couple iterations, they at least should be the same each time. We'd expect this to produce nice, consistent measurements. So here's a plot of the measurements I got running this on a fairly quiet computer. Note that this is a log scale. So these peaks up here are like a million times slower than the normal measurements. So who has a guess as to what was going on to cause these peaks? And it's related to why you could still use the lab machine if I was running that program. Yes?
The OS is switching and running some other process?
Yeah, so some other program got run. And it had to take some time on the processor, and that's the times it took. And so this is called time multiplexing. We're sharing the CPU. And so from our point of view, we have a CPU, and it just happens that it stalls randomly for a very, very long amount of time. But it's still a correct CPU that executes our instructions correctly. It just has these random million cycle stalls. So when we're measuring time, occasionally we will run this instruction, you know, run the move of the time we just read into a register, and occasionally there will be this million cycle delay before we can get the next time. Otherwise, it looks like a correct processor. And what's going on underneath is during what we think is just that our processor stalls for a million cycles, but otherwise behaves correctly, that the OS managed to run some other programs that happen to be sitting around in my system. And presumably something similar was going on even in some of the less extreme peaks here, like this and this and these. And so this is what operating systems do to give you the illusion you have your own CPU. They're sharing this each core between the different programs. And what's really going on, it's not the case that something happens and we immediately start running the other program. Some code has to run to do that. And so what actually happens is our loop was running, and then something happened and the operating system started running and then switched to the other program. The operating system mediated this choice. It figured out what program to run next, and it got control. It wasn't that the processor directly figured out, I'm going to run SSH next. It doesn't have that sort of logic in it. It has to be implemented in software in the OS. And the thing which caused the OS to start running is what we call an exception. So an exception is something where the processor is giving control to the OS from a program that may have just been running normally. So it just starts running the OS in the middle of possibly completely unrelated code. And when the OS returns from an exception, it can arrange to run a different program, which is really handy, because we probably like that when I run that infinite loop on Lab Unix 1, you can actually still use it. And so basically what the OS is doing is when the processor starts running it, it's saving the old program counter, saving where we are, what instruction to run next, and all our register values, like the value of RVX in my example there where I had an old time, the values of my stack pointer. And then it needs to load the next program. So somewhere it has a copy of, say, SSH's register values, and it copies them back into the registers and jumps to the program counter where SSH was running when it stopped it sometime before. So this whole process is called a context switch. And the name comes because the information that is saved and restored is called a context. So the program counter and those registers are the context of the program. So our context is all register values. Notably, this includes register values that are pointers. So we don't save the stack as part of the context, but we save the information about where to find the stack as part of the context. We also need to save some other things that are maybe a little less obvious. We need to save the condition codes. If I run a compare instruction, then we have that the OS takes control right afterwards, and then I have a conditional jump that it needs to go back to when it context switched back to me. We don't want the condition codes to have changed, so the OS also needs to save and restore the condition codes. And if you remember when we talked about Y86 and the state in our processor, this is all the state in our processor. Essentially, we're taking everything kept in our processor and pushing it somewhere else. And so basically what our context switch is doing is that the OS is taking all the register and PC values, putting them in memory somewhere to remember what was running, and then loading something else that was stored in memory before. And so what that looks like is that we have, say, process A on the CPU. So all its context is conceptually just in the CPU. And we have some other program that's conceptually has been started but isn't on the CPU at the moment. And its context is stored somewhere in the OS's memory. The OS remembers all its register values, its condition codes, and what it's going to do is it's just going to have these two change places. And by just swapping that state in the CPU, now we're running process B. And we didn't need to worry about the values in memory because we just changed the pointers around. So it didn't matter that we didn't actually like copy all of process A out of memory or into memory. We'll talk a little more about how that actually works since it's a tad more complicated. But the key idea is the context is very small, which is good because we want to switch programs very quickly. That big spike there, that was like milliseconds. You can't copy megabytes of data in milliseconds. You're copying, I guess you can copy megabytes of data. You don't want to be copying megabytes of data if you're going to only run something for a millisecond with that data. So speaking of memory, here are two programs. So I have a program A, where I have some constant data stored at address 10,000 hex, and I access it at some point. And I have a program B, which has a move instruction that just writes to address 10,000. So if I run both of these programs at the same time, such that program B gets run in the middle of program A running, what should happen? What would you want to happen? Yeah.
Program B stores its RAX and memory address for 10,000 somewhere else, and then moves back to where it retakes program A's data and back to RAX and back to the 10,000.
Okay, so what will program A read then?
It would read word 42.
It would read 42. And this is so you say it would restore the value?
Yeah, restore it, but like this is just virtual memory, so
okay, yeah, so we're going to get to later that these addresses aren't the real addresses, which is going to be our mechanism. So if you actually run this, what's going to happen, most likely, is that program A will always, always get 42. It doesn't matter what program B does. And that sure would be useful because we wouldn't like random people doing bad things to memory to mess up the program you're writing on Live Unix 1. And program B might crash, might do something else, but it's never going to make program A output a different value. And as alluded to, there's something called virtual memory, which we'll talk a lot more about next week, which is the actual mechanism which makes this happen. I'm going to give sort of a high level, more motivational view, and next week we'll talk about like all the details of how that's implemented in hardware. So if you remember from way earlier in the semester, I gave you this layout of program memory. Said that on Linux, 64-bit Linux, usually code starts at address 40,000 hex. We have our stack at approximately the same address, and the data is always the same thing. This means if we have two programs, it looks like they overlap in memory. And that's kind of a problem for what I told you earlier, that we're just going to store a pointer to the stack, we're going to store a pointer to the PC, and expect that to work out. How can we do that if the two programs we want to be on the computer at the same time have their code in the same place? And the answer is that they aren't really going to have their code in the same place. So we're going to give programs the illusion that they have their own memory, so they can both own the same addresses. And the way we're going to implement that is that whenever program A tries to access an address, the processor is going to have this mapping that the OS will set when it switches to program A. And that mapping is going to say, every time you access an address, whether it's an instruction, whether it's a data address, we're going to use this mapping first and find the real address to access. And that's where we're going to go. And the OS gets to set this mapping, and it's going to set the add mappings for two programs so they don't overlap. So neither of them can accidentally access the memory of the other. So the name of the modern version of this mechanism is virtual memory, and that's going to be what the format of the mapping is. But the key idea, which there are other ways of implementing, is that we have this mapping the OS sets every time we do a context switch. And that's how we keep the programs isolated from each other. They just can't name the addresses that correspond to the memory of the other program, because the mapping doesn't let that happen. So another thing you might know about program memory is that we have these giant holes. You have these addresses you can't access, and who knows what they've seen happen when you try to access them on any system. When you access this, there's these big gaps in memory. Segmentation fault. Yes. So you get some sort of error. And the way that basically works is that another thing this mapping can do is it can map things to nothing. So another option for the mapping is that it doesn't map to a memory location, it maps to please trigger an error processor. We'll talk more about what that error, format error takes in a bit. So as I said, virtual memory is the mechanism that modern processors use to implement this. And in that mechanism, the mapping is called a page table. And this is part of what's going to be changed in a context switch. So that means that when I showed you the context earlier, we need a little bit extra. We have this address space that also needs to change. We need to change the mapping and restore and save the old mapping whenever we switch between two programs. That's going to, we're going to do just like we do the register values. So when we put these two concepts together, we have our time multiplexing, where we take something that's running on the CPU, stop it, and start it later. And we have this address space, where every program has its own mapping of how its addresses translate into real addresses. And these are both managed by the operating system. This is the first time we've ever really talked about the operating system. The thing the operating system has given us is called a process. So a process here is a combination of two things. So one thing is called a thread. So the idea that you own the CPU, and yet you're run with other things potentially, that's a thread. So that's the time multiplexing part. That's where we run on the CPU for a bit, an exception happens, something else runs. To us, it looks like we have our own CPU. It just happens that the CPU has this very weird timing where sometimes an instruction takes an extra million cycles for no reason. But as far as we're concerned, as far as correctness goes, it looks like we have our own CPU. So that idea is called a thread. We also have our own address space. So it looks like we have our own memory. It looks like nothing but stuff for us is in memory. And we can't access anyone else's memory. So that idea is called an address space. So the combination of the two is known as a process. You might hear about programming with threads. So threads are where, if you're programming with threads, when someone says that, they usually mean you have multiple fake CPUs that you think you own, but they might share an address space. They might have common memory. With a process, we mean they have separate CPU and separate memory. So for the rest of today, I'm going to focus on things related to exceptions, which is about our thread side of things. So next week, we're going to, and for the basically all the remaining lectures after that, because it turns out virtual memory is a complicated concept, we're going to talk about how the address spaces are implemented. So exceptions, as I said, are a way for the operating system to get control, even though there's no instruction saying, please run the OS, necessarily. And there's going to be two kinds of exceptions we're going to talk about. This is just a division your book makes. You might not see it everywhere, but it's useful to think about this. So there's going to be some exceptions we're going to talk about where what the processor does to give the OS control was triggered by a particular instruction, that the program did something, and that meant the OS needed to run. So these are things we'll call traps and faults. I'll tell you exactly what those are in a bit. And that's something like you access memory you're not supposed to. There's a particular instruction where you access memory you weren't supposed to that triggered that. And that's going to be an exception because the processor doesn't know what to do. It needs to ask the OS, hey OS, something accessed bad memory. What do you want me to do about it? And for example, in your experience, what you saw the OS do is crash the program. But the OS needed to run some code to do that, it needs to run code that like, gets rid of the program from memory, and so on. The processor doesn't know how to do that, and it wouldn't make sense to integrate that functionality in the processor. We also have exceptions which are asynchronous, which come from outside the program, where we're doing something like executing our infinite loop, and there's nothing in our infinite loop which suggests that something needs to happen, that the OS needs to do something. But some event outside, such as a timer expiring, which is typically how the operating systems arrange to run other programs, caused an exception meant the OS needed to run. It wasn't anything to do with our program. So given these categories, we have this taxonomy of exception types from our book. So the first tech we have here are interrupts. So these are externally triggered events where something that is conceptually outside the processor caused an event to happen that the OS should respond to. And this includes timer interrupts. So when we have that switching from one program to the other, that's an interrupt from this timer device, which is conceptually not part of the CPU, but it might be on the same chip. But it's not like one of the, doesn't use the general purpose registers. It's some device the OS talks to as if it were an I/O device, as if it were something like a keyboard. And that it says every once in a while, hey, I expired, I finished my time, and the OS gets to run in response to that. Another example of externally triggered events are I/O devices. If I press a key on the keyboard, that's going to mean that the OS might want to know about that, and this is the mechanism by which the OS gets to run to actually respond to that promptly. So, second type of exceptions here are faults. So this is where the name like segmentation fault comes from. These are events or errors in program. So these are examples of something which are triggered by a particular instruction. So you access memory that's not in your address space. That's one of these faults. Because there's some instruction you ran, probably like a move instruction, maybe, or something like that, which did something that the processor didn't know how to handle. So what the processor did is say, hey OS, I didn't know how to handle this. Why don't you decide what to do? And the US can make a decision about what to do. Probably the only decision you know of is crashing the program, but it has other options if it so chooses. And this also applies to things like dividing by zero. This is, processor might decide that rather than doing something random, it's going to ask the OS, hey, this program divided by zero, what do you want me to do about it? Or if you run an invalid instruction, like you saw, you had to implement that for y86, what real processors will do with that is to ask the OS, hey, this program ran an invalid instruction, what do you want me to do about it? So our third category here are traps. So these, like faults, have a particular instruction that's responsible for them. But unlike faults, it's not like a move instruction, which usually works, or divide instruction, which usually works. This is an instruction whose entire purpose is to trigger an exception. And the typical idea of this is that we want the operating system to do something, and for some reason, which I will explain later today, we're not going to just call a function in the operating system. We're going to trigger an exception and have the processor give the operating system control that way. We also have this third category of aborts. Get to in a bit. So traps. So an example of a trap is these things called system calls. They're called system calls because I'm asking the operating system to do something for me. I'm calling a function in the operating system, conceptually. So an example is, let's say I want to read from a keyboard. Typically, the way that's going to work is I'm going to run my program that reads input, and it's going to ask the OS, hey OS, I'd like to read a character from the keyboard. And rather than, just asking the keyboard over and over again, hey, do you have input for me? Do you have input for me? The OS is just going to run something else. So I have this trap where I gave control to the OS, and the OS is not going to switch back to me because it doesn't have my input yet. So it's going to run something else rather than waste the CPU time. And then later on, the keyboard's going to trigger an interrupt. It's going to cause the processor to start running the OS. The OS is going to look at that and say, oh, the keyboard has input. Let me see who's waiting for that. Oh, this read input program is. And it's going to start running that read input program instead of what it was running before. This is an example of how the OS takes advantage of these exceptions to do the sort of services you're used to on a computer that runs multiple programs. So we have this last category called aborts. I think it is kind of unfortunate that the book has this category. Because not every processor really thinks this is a distinct category, really, and the book is kind of vague on distinguishing between faults and aborts. So I believe the intention of this category is that this refers to serious hardware issues that might be kind of associated with the program that's running, might not, and typically require the OS to do something strange. So for example, memory will sometimes tell the processor, I'm broken. So if you have bad RAM, sometimes the processor can detect this, and the type of reaction the processor is going to have to this is typically triggering an exception that our textbook will classify as an abort. So if you have bad RAM and you're an operating system, you don't want to just stop the current program. You either want to log it and hope you can keep going, or stop the whole machine. Because if you have bad RAM, who knows what's going on. And that's the sort of thing that classifies as aborts, is that something weird is happening in the hardware that the OS should deal with right away. That may or may not be related to what the program just did. Maybe the program accessed the RAM and that triggered the error, maybe just happened. But it's something that the OS needs to take care of, that something is broken. That's, I believe, the sort of category they're referring to. This is the least important category of exceptions. So I told you about the kinds of scenarios in which we have exceptions and sort of how the OS uses them to actually make our programs do what we expect them to do. I'm going to talk a bit about what it means to implement exceptions, both in hardware and in software. So we'll start with what the hardware does. So there are three big steps that hardware needs to do to implement exceptions. You might see hardware do a bit more than this, but that's not strictly necessary. So one thing is it needs to detect that an exception happened. So you need to detect like that you tried to execute an invalid instruction, so you've seen how to do that. Or you need to detect that, hey, someone pressed a key on the keyboard, so you need some wire going into the processor that tells you that. So you have some way of detecting that this external event or internal event happened, and I need to do an exception now. Next thing you need to do is you need to save the program counter somewhere. If we don't save the program counter, there's no reason we'll remember where we stopped. And if we don't remember where we stopped, there's no way the OS can restart the program later, which we know, at least for some types of exceptions, we want to do. Like for a timer interrupt, it would be really bad if the OS had to guess what instruction to restart at, because then your program would not behave very well. And after we've saved the PC, we want to jump to this exception handler, which is going to be some function written in the OS. And this is a jump without any program instruction actually saying where to jump to. And this jump is going to overwrite the PC, which is why you better save it first. And that's sort of the minimum the hardware needs to do to make exceptions work. So I'm going to talk about implementation in a bit more detail, and this is a simplified version. And our textbook also describes a simplified version that may look a little bit different. X86 has a lot of history, and this shows up much more than any other place in how exceptions work on X86. So like if you try to look this up like in the X86 manual, you'll find that there's a lot of extra stuff going on that's mostly because X86 is trying to be compatible with old processors, not because it's like an essential part of handling exceptions. So the typical basic way we have running exceptions, we need to know where it is. Most commonly, we're going to have a table, which I'll call an exception table, which tells us where exception handlers are. And the reason we'll have a table is that we want to do very different things for each kind of exception. When I have a divide by zero, I want to react to that very differently than if I have a timer interrupt. I'm going to do something different, and the processor is going to help us out with this by running different pieces of code depending on the kind of exception we have. And to figure out where all these are, we're going to have this table with one entry for each possible kind of exception with pointers to the code you want to run. And to tell the processor where that table is, we're going to add one special register called the exception table base register. So the OS is going to set that when it boots the processor. It's going to have this table set up in the OS's memory, pointing to all its routines for handling timer interrupts, divide by zeros, protection faults, and so on. And so after the hardware saves the old program counter, it looks in this exception table to figure out where the actual place it wants to jump to is, then jumps to that function. And then the OS can like save any data it wants to and actually do a context switch or do any other decisions it wants to do. So what we've added to the CPU to implement this is going to be, first, we need a way to access that new special register. So we're going to have some new instruction that sets the exception table base register. It's not a normal register. Wouldn't really make sense to make that accessible to programs because they probably want to use it. That'd be bad. So we'll have a special instruction to set the exception table base register. We're going to have new logic which knows how to read from the exception table based on the exception number and get the new PC we want. So we're going to have to add that to our processor. That's not too hard to implement. It's like an adder before the data memory. We sort of need to make sure we're not writing another thing which accesses the data memory while we're doing that. That's a little extra logic in our processor. And we need logic to save the old PC. So one way you might do this is by adding an extra register to your processor to save the PC. And save the PC that you had before an exception. Another way you might do it is by writing it to memory, like you would for a call instruction, something similar to that. And we also are going to need a new instruction to return from the exception. when we're done with the exception, we want to jump back to either the program that was running originally or some different program. But in either case, we want to jump back from the exception. So it's not obvious that we need a new instruction because, hey, we have jump, what more do we need? So what's the problem with jump? So there are two reasons why we need additional instruction here. So one is going to be reasons related to what we'll call protection, which I'll talk about later. But that's one important reason we're going to have a separate instruction for returning from exception in loops. But you might say, well, besides that thing we don't know about, couldn't you just ret? That's an instruction that we know how to implement, that reads something off the stack. We could just push the address we want to return to on the stack and return. And the problem with that is that we really care about providing the illusion of a dedicated CPU and memory. And we want to maintain this illusion, even for programs which do something weird, like store values at the wrong side of the stack pointer. Because our assumption is that it's like you own the CPU, even though this violates the calling convention, that should still work. The OS shouldn't mess it up because you have a timer interrupt. And so it would violate our contract to store that, to make that not happen. So we want it to be undetectable to the program, so when there's a timer interrupt, all the program sees is that, hey, that move instruction apparently stalled for a million cycles. It doesn't get any way to notice that we stopped it and restarted it. So that's another reason we're going to want a special instruction. So I've told you what the hardware has, so let's talk about what the OS code looks like from a high level. So what the OS code for every exception handler is doing is we're saving the process's state somewhere for the OS to maybe use later. We're doing work to handle the exception. So on a timer interrupt, that work is choose what to run next. On a segmentation fault, that work is how do we crash this program? Well, how do we get rid of it from memory and tell something else that it crashed? Then we choose a process we want to run next. It might be the same process, it might be a different one. And we restore that process's state and then jump back to the program with that special instruction. So what's conceptually happening in our time slicing example is that when that timer interrupt happens, we end up setting all the values for, say, SSH in this case, and returning from the exception, not running loop.exe anymore, but running SSH. So any questions about sort of what we do in exception handlers and how they're run? So now that we know how they work, here's a question. So, I told you there's a special instruction to set the exception table base register. So why can't I write this next little program, a new version of my infinite loop program? So what I'm going to do here is I'm just going to set the exception table base register to my exception table. And I have a much better timer interrupt handler. My timer interrupt handler just returns. Just returns, keeps running the same program. It's going to be great. Going to get toggle the CPU. So presumably this doesn't work. So what's going to happen? What do you think would happen? Well, is going to happen if I try to run this code? Yeah. Okay. So you're saying I'm going to get a fault because I'm not allowed to change the exception table.
Yes.
So that's essentially what's going to happen. It's not because it's in memory. It's because of something very related. So there's a special instruction to write the exception table on x86 that's called LIDT for load interrupt descriptor table. And when I try to run that, I get a segmentation fault. And it's not that this is trying to write to memory that's not mine. I, in fact, have the exception table in my memory, and in fact, I'm just trying to set the register that points to it. But I can't do that because we've decided not to let any null program just set the exception table. We don't want to let that happen. And this is very important if we want to allow the machine to be shared between users. We don't just want any old user writing that program I showed you there and using all the CPU forever. Because they just said, oh, I don't care about the OS's timer interrupt handler. Mine will just keep the CPU to me. I'll get a lot more work done. Great. And so, for example, the instruction to set the exception table or set the address space or talk to I/O devices, these things aren't going to be allowed for most programs. And the way this is going to be implemented is our processor is going to have two modes. We're going to have kernel mode, where the operating system will do work that needs these instructions. And in that mode, the privilege instructions will work. And we'll have user mode. In user mode, the privilege instructions will cause an exception, a fault, instead. So the hardware implementation is that we add an extra 1-bit register. Are we in kernel mode? And we also need to be able to start kernel mode and end kernel mode. So the way we're going to do that is that exceptions will always enter kernel mode, because that's where the OS might need to do stuff. And we're running the OS, so it should be okay. And returning from exception, that special instruction, the other reason we'll have a special instruction for it is that in addition to jumping back to the program, it's going to exit kernel mode. So it's going to get us back to a state where the program can't reset the exception table. And this leads to another anomaly on our picture of program memory layout. There's this big region at the top I labeled as used by OS and have as part of a blacked out region. And this is memory that in Linux's memory layout is like where Linux puts the exception handlers and thing in the exception table and things like that. And another option in the mapping we have is that we can set parts of the mapping as only works in kernel mode. So when the processor looks at the mapping, it says, are we in kernel mode? If so, great. If not, I'm going to pretend it was mapped to trigger an error. Yes. And generally, the name for what happens when we trigger the fault based on we did something that would work in kernel mode but doesn't work because we're in user mode is called a protection fault. So if a program tries to access bad memory, tries to do things that aren't allowed, this is a protection fault. And that means the OS gets control and it gets to decide what to do. And the action we've seen is crash the program. You get the segmentation fault message. That's the OS getting this fault and deciding, I'm going to just get rid of this program that's running. It doesn't have anything useful to do. So this notion of privileged instructions also reveals why we're using traps, why we have instructions whose only purpose is to trigger an exception. The reason we want those is because we want to do things that require kernel mode in our programs. I want to talk to the I/O device. I want to allocate memory, which involves changing that address space mapping. These are all things which I can't do in my own program, not because I can't write the code to do them, but because I can't use those privileged instructions. We need a way to get into kernel mode to run those privileged instructions, to ask the OS to do something for us. And traps are the way to do that, and that's why we can't just use a function call. A function call is not going to change into kernel mode. A trap is going to do that, because it is an exception. So all these kernel services, allocating memory, reading files, reading input, they all need these privileged instructions, so we use a deliberate exception, a trap, to do that. So I'm going to go through what this looks like on Linux. And I'm talking about 64-bit x86 Linux. This is different on like every OS and architecture combination. I'm just talking about 64-bit x86 Linux. There, the most common way of doing system calls is with a special instruction called syscall. So syscall is an instruction which triggers a trap. The only purpose of the instruction is to cause an exception. And syscalls look kind of like a function call. Except, of course, they don't call a function like that you specify there. They just trigger a particular exception with a particular number. And Linux has a convention for how you use syscalls. You set up your registers kind of like you were doing a function call, and then when the processor is returned back to you after the OS has run, it's changed your registers to reflect the result of the system call. And it did that because it had your context with copies of all your registers. It just modified the value of RAX in there before it restored your state and returned from the exception. So it looks very much like a function call. There's a slightly different calling convention. So you note that the syscall instruction, it doesn't take any arguments. It just says syscall. And we want to specify different types of things we want the OS to do. Sometimes we want to read, sometimes we want to write. We need to specify what operations we're doing. So there's a system called number, and that by convention, just a choice Linux made is stored in RAX, that says which operation would you like the operating system to do for you. And also there's a bunch of registers that where the Linux expects its arguments for the system call. And it will look in those registers. It just pulls them out of the context it saved for you to figure out what you want to do. So here's an example of some code that uses a system call. So this is a complete program. Note that there's no main. So main, as you typically use it, is something which is set up by the C library, which has ways of going or wrapping around system calls and keeping you from having to deal with all those details. Here, I'm doing everything without any library support. I'm just writing this raw. This is minimal Linux program that only works on x86, 64 Linux, and absolutely nothing else. So, remember, our calling convention was that we have to put the service we want, which thing we want the operating system to do, in RAX. And there are numbers assigned to each possible thing you could want to do. There's this giant list of several hundred of them. And it turns out that number one is something called write. And that's how I can write, for example, to my output. And it takes some arguments. The first argument is something called a file descriptor. This is a concept in Linux referring to which file of the ones I have open should I write to. And one refers to standard out, the normal output, which is usually our terminal. Then I need to specify the value to write. So I move my string, a pointer to my string into one of the argument registers, and also the length of the string, how much I want to write, into one of those argument registers. Then I run this syscall instruction. So the syscall instruction, that's going to run the exception handler, and it's going to save my context, and it's going to look inside that context and decide, what do I want to do right now? It's going to say, oh, RAX is one, I'm going to do the write thing. And it's eventually going to set a return value in RAX to say what the result of the write is. In this code, I'm completely ignoring that. But in real code, you probably wouldn't want to do that. And then we're going to return from that exception handler. So eventually, the OS is going to finish writing the string to our terminal for us. And it's going to return. And it's going to arrange to return that the next instruction it runs is the run right after the syscall. So it looks very much like a normal function call. And here we have another system call. So I set service number 60, which I set as exit. And the reason I'm doing that is that, well, let's just say I return. So if I return, I'm actually not returning to anything. This underscore start is not the name of a function. It's the name of where the OS starts running my program. It doesn't set up anything on the stack. There's no return address. So if I return, I'm just reading junk off the stack and jumping there, it's going to crash. If I don't put anything, well, there's something in memory after that syscall instruction. It's going to try to be run as instructions, and it's probably going to do something really weird. And if I want to stop running my program, I need to tell the OS, hey, OS, I want to stop running now. Can you please stop me? And so to do that, we use a system call. In this case, a system call for exit. And it also happens to take one argument, which is called an exit status. If you know your shell, sometimes says program failed or didn't. That's how it knows. So we're passing a status of 0, which means worked fine, and calling, making a syscall. And this syscall, just because the service we're asking for is please get rid of my program, we're going to trigger the trap, we're going to run the operating system, and it's going to just get rid of our program and never return. So any questions about this code here? And sort of what system calls do in general? Okay. So sort of the thing which is going on in the middle of handling the system call is probably something like this, that we have our code exception handler, which saves all the registers, you know, stashes things somewhere. Then we just have a big table of all the different services we provide, and just like you might have seen for, you know, handling a switch, we just jump to the appropriate entry of that table and handle whatever system call the program requested. And Linux, as I said, has hundreds of system calls. This is pretty common on pretty much every OS. You don't always get to access them directly. So for example, there's system calls for allocating memory, for creating a new process. If you want to run a new program, you can't do that yourself. You can't set a new address space up. You have to ask the OS to do it. There's for running a different program, for exiting, for reading, opening, closing files. Those are all system calls, all things the OS needs to take care of, and which involve potentially privileged instructions somewhere, or data in the OS's memory that you can't access in user mode. So they're all things where you need to enter kernel mode in order to do what we need to do. And this is the way that the OS controls what programs can do. Because exceptions are the only way to enter kernel mode from user mode, as long as the OS is really, really careful about what processes can do, what exception handlers can do, it controls, therefore, what processes can do. But it means that the OS needs to be really, really careful about how it writes its exception handlers. So, for example, its exception handlers can't trust the stack pointer. You can't trust it. The user stack pointer might be set to an address which is most inconvenient. And you can't let that make the user, for example, write to the exception table. That would be really bad. You have to trust absolutely nothing. And you also need to check all your inputs really carefully. So you saw here that we passed a pointer to the system call. The operating system needs to make sure that pointer goes to memory that the program can access and not to some memory that's important to the OS. Like, but by doing this, doing this really carefully, that's how we actually provide our overall protection, that you can't change what other programs do, you can't change what the OS does beyond what you're supposed to be able to do. And it looks like you have your machine with access to external things that the OS chooses to give you access to and nothing else. I think that's all I have for today in the interest of not going too far ahead of the other class. So next time we'll finish up exceptions. and possibly start virtual memory, which, as I said, will be the topic for the remainder of the class, unless we're somehow really fast.